Hello, my name is Neil Young. I'm the Managing Director of Elixir Energy. Very pleased to be talking with you again, Matt.
And good to see you. Good to see you. Like we've done a few macro sessions of, well, yourself and
Fine.
Merlin have, and we kind of caught up, was it, well, almost a couple of weeks ago with regards to the sort of more technical aspects of the business here. My question is a bit more simple. This seems to be a perfect market for gas companies, oil companies as well. What are you doing about it? How are you going to take advantage of it?
Well, we're right in the middle of a program which is very well placed to take advantage of it. But I'll just recap, and there's a slide up here to do so on the macro context that's led to that, if that's okay. So, really, sort of 3 points. Firstly, no one wants it to be the case, but the reality is the desired energy transition is very, very hard. It's going to take a very long time. And any credible forecaster sees that the role of gas will be one that will endure for many decades. And in fact, gas demand will grow. In terms of internationally traded gas markets, Shell recently put out their annual outlook. They say it's going to grow for again, many decades. And in particular, in Asia, which is where we are. Australia it has been a very reliable supplier. So, for instance, if I compare us to Russian LNG, we are somewhat more reliable for people who buy it in Japan, South Korea, etc. And then in Australia and East Coast Australia in particular, we have now a very imminent supply-demand gap that is growing very rapidly. Government interventions have been cack-handed and made it worse. We now have in effect, a gas price floor of about $12 Australian. And just to put that into context, because it's relevant to the economics, I mean, that's in oil terms, that's about $50 US a barrel. So in terms of long-term oil pricing, this is almost oil parity. And that's just so different than, for instance, investing in the States or places where gas is cheap. And it really makes you think about the economics of wells in quite different ways when compared to cheap gas countries. And Australia used to be a cheap gas country.
Can I just again for a much broader audience here, just to make sure we understand the kind of the setup for this, the setup for your company is, in my banking days, we obviously it was kind of pre anti-fossil fuel agenda, but gas seemed to get a kind of free pass in Europe. It started being labeled as a green energy, green gas. When you're talking about energy transitions being difficult, is gas getting a hard time in Australia? I get the it's got to we've got to go from whatever people I don't know what people are expecting in Australia, wind, solar, etc. But
There
is
is
gas going to get
opposition
that free pass over
from the
there?
Green Left, including some state government who are against it because of their need to pander to sort of inner city votes that tend to go that way. So now gas's free pass has really evaporated in that Green Left political sense, but in any scientific sense, it's still very clean burning, not only in terms of CO2 emissions being much less than for coal, but also in terms of not having nasties that when you burn coal or indeed liquid fuels tend to cause sort of like local atmospheric pollution. So in both a global and a local sense, it is a much cleaner burning thing. People are concerned about fugitive emissions where the methane goes into the atmosphere. It is a significant greenhouse gas in and of itself. But our industry is incentivized, particularly when the gas price is $12, not to let it be a fugitive emission. So there's a pretty strong a capitalist imperative there to fix that perceived problem.
Right, and I suspect you're going to sort of talk me through, what you're doing in terms of being able to extract and supply into the grid in a second. But what's the competition like? Can we see a sustained price environment as you're describing? Because that's going to be critical for you in terms of funding and the bankers, and obviously, clearly, then the investors. So, can you give us a sense of what that looks like going forward?
So the competition in Eastern Australia is really sort of set by the context that the very high-class conventional gas fields are now very, very mature in significant and irreversible decline. Now, they, in the last decade or two, have been supplemented by coal seam gas from Queensland in particular, but that has now arguably peaked and start to be in decline. Now, what that has meant is that there is at least one LNG import project which has been FID'd and will import gas by LNG. That sets a pretty high pricing benchmark. There are a couple of other projects that are also being mooted to be that too. So the need is for more gas to come on. It can be either imported by boat or developed locally. There are further flung places in Australia, such as the Northern Territory, which have got a lot of gas resource, but it, again, is much further away and comes at a significant cost to get to the markets that we're much closer to where we're operating.
Okay, well, let's talk about this. Let's move into the meat of this, which is how do you kind of commercialize your business? So you had some results out recently, test results.
Uh-huh.
They look encouraging. Can you give us a sort of sense of, you know, what you've been up to recently, the last few months since we last spoke?
So at the end of last year, we drilled a deep well targeting unconventional gas in tight sandstones and deep tight coals. We very surprisingly and uniquely got a kick of gas into the wellbore from a deep permeable zone that no one expected. So we've been thinking about what that means. So after the Christmas break, we went back, we did lab work on a few things. We analyzed the sandstone qualities in that zone that free flowed, and they had chemical analogs with the deep Perth Basin in Western Australia, which again has had free-flowing gas from deep zones that no one expected. So that gave us a reason as to why this occurred and why it could be more extensive. We also undertook analysis on the deep coals, and we found out there was a lot more gas in place in them than we thought. That boosted massively our prospective resources in the coals, and part of our imminent program is to flow the coals and get contingent resource. So lab work, getting set up for the next stages of stimulating now three different zones in six different stimulation phases. To inform that, we undertook diagnostic fracture injectivity tests, DFITs, and the one that we did into the free-flowing zone was sufficiently encouraging for us last week to see if it could flow without stimulation. And it was possible that this might just be small or didn't have what I would technically call the guts to lift, you know, 4,200 meters of water out of the well. But it did, and really has some very strong results. So that was enormously encouraging for us. And it's only the first stage of this program of stimulation and flow testing for the totality of the well to follow in the next few months.
Okay, but to what end? What are you actually trying to do? Because all this conversation to be end up at me understanding the kind of commercial realities of what you've got here. So this is the first phase. What more do you need to do? How much more do you need to spend? How long is it going to take to get through this phase?
So the next phases are to build upon the flow rate that we achieved last week by flowing zones above that, then aggregating them to a flow rate which we would consider to be commercial. Now, commercial here rests on effectively three primary factors: flow rate, gas price, which is very high, location, where you avoid gas transmission costs, which is very good. So we think a totality of flow rates achieved from multiple zones will likely now get to a commercial reality in the next few months. And then that triggers other things. Critically, it triggers progress on the farm out discussions we're having with large parties who we believe will be critical to supply the capital required to develop this asset, to supply those local markets and international markets, which can be accessed here. So it's really deliver ourselves as a standalone junior, bring in bigger parties who can then help develop, and that this development could be very substantial. It's a very, very significant resource here.
Right. Okay. And let's, what we've seen over the past sort of difficult 3 years where the equities perhaps are struggling across the board in whatever natural resource commodity you want to point at, you know, you guys are no different here, is changing business plans, changing the speed at which they go to market. And by that I mean try and get into some kind of near-term, position themselves, get into a near-term revenue situation. With the way that you develop fields, the way you manage fields, and the way that you manage or trying to manage those flow rates across the entire field, is gas any different? Is there a kind of quicker route to market? per se?
There is, and typically a development like this would be staggered. I mean, at the very front end level, what you can do with a well like this, which is an appraisal well, not designed to be a production well, but it can be used for that. Now, we could hoard it for a later development, or we could flow gas into a local generator and create bitcoins or feed AI and help the well get taken over. Or we could, at relatively modest rates, given we're only like 50 or so clicks from the end of our permit to what's called the Wallumbilla Hub, the primary gas trading hub in Australia.
Do you mind pulling that up? Because, I mean, you've got your deck there. So I want to sort of see, remind people where you're at.
Here's a map here that really brings that out. Our permit's in green. That's in the Bowen Basin, which is an enormously prolific basin for coal seam gas, and now tight gas and deep permeable gas. So it's an amazing geological formation. So we see just to our northwest the Wallumbilla Gas Hub, which connects Queensland gas to take it south to the southern states. It connects to the Gladstone port, which has six trains of liquefaction capacity, which is now facing a growing ullage. So it's a great location for that. But in oil and gas, as in most resources, there are other issues that count as well. You've got to have communities who are not going to block you. And here we've had oil and gas for nearly 100 years. People know it, they make money from it, and they respect it. It's when you go to a new area, you tend to have bigger problems. And that substantial existing play means that the service sector here is already present. It's like a couple of hours drive away. You know, if you break a tool or something and you're in the middle of nowhere, well, it takes you 2 days to fix it. Here, it takes you a couple of hours. And so all those factors are pretty significant, economic as well as political, cultural, cost saving.
Right. And we're looking, I'm looking at Brisbane there, where I was born. Who would you believe with this dodgy accent? So that's a kind of pretty big urban hub. How do you get? So is it quite an easy process to actually plug into the grid and sell into the grid?
I think another slide, because not only can you supply gas direct by the pipeline, which isn't red there, to Brisbane gas markets, but what you have here is extensive power markets, very adjacent. On this map here, everything in blue is a gas-fired power station. There are coal-fired power stations, there's solar, there is a plan to significantly enhance the gas-fired power station network here at a location called Cogan Creek. And that basically, particularly in Australia where you've got very large renewable and growing penetration, you need gas to balance everything out. And so those gas-fired peakers are going to need to work for a long time. There's gas storage that already exists here in about three separate gas storage projects. There are going to need to be more. That's going to be far cheaper than pumped hydro, far more reliable than battery. So it's a great location to feed those power markets as well as those international southern markets, Brisbane markets. So it's an enormously intense and favorable market location.
Right. And with regards to those different markets, the pricing is fairly ubiquitous. It's right, but how do you then? How do you start a process where you say, right, I think I can get into a revenue situation quickly? In terms of that managing the field, you said there's a potential there. Is there a need though? Because again, so coming back to this business model that we've seen, there is a need because some companies are kind of, you know, driving themselves into the ground with, you know, continual dilutive fundraising with kind of no end in sight and hoping that the market sort of pops up for them and, you know, does the heavy lifting for them. For you guys, have you kind of looked at or experimented with, you know, in terms of conversations with ways of funding the development of this project?
We have, obviously, equity markets are there, but they are tough. We have been successful in getting some non-dilutive funding in a couple of sources from the federal government through the R&D nature of our program. We shared data with a big overlapping company called Origin Energy, who's got a CCS project here. They basically contributed to our well cost in order to get data, so that was pretty cute. In terms of doing gas sales, you can go too early and do unfavorable deals when you're a junior. So you've got to balance out going too early versus waiting until you've got more strength. And strength often comes from a partner. And my view is, you know, what's the most attractive source of capital if you're a junior in a resources sector? And in gas, which is very capital intensive, this is even truer. And the answer is big companies. They've got money, but also they've got expertise. They've got political skills. They validate plays in the eyes of the investors for small cap like ours. So this location is really attractive to large companies for a few reasons. Firstly, large companies are already there, so you can deal with them. But also even the ones who aren't there, big companies are very conservative. No one wants to take a risk when they're an employee in a big company. But if you go where Fred Bloggs already is, you're not taking a risk. You know, he's already validated the play. You need to be low emissions, and we've confirmed that CO2 here is very low. There's no CO2 separation. That means lower cost and lower political risk. And if you're Shell or whatever, you're not going to go in a high CO2 play. Then in big companies, they're not going to small plays, they're only going to big plays. And this is very large, materiality is very big. Sovereign risk is low. Australia government can be a bit painful from time to time, but like, hey, look at every government in the world, and we're probably still after some states in America and some states in Canada, we're about next. And then this is an unconventional play. You're not making a decision to invest in a deep water offshore platform. It's a $5 billion yes or no investment. Here you can put in $100 million, $500 million, $1 billion. You can scale it up and down. So all of those factors really come together for a favorable location to attract what I think is the best source of capital here, third-party capital from big parties. And we're engaging with that sort of party just now. I think our results announced last week will help. And then our results over the next 2 months will greatly help as well.
Well, what's that look like? Is it the amount of small companies over the years that have come on and said, don't worry, we've got all these big players next door. We're so attractive. they won't be able to resist. But the truth is these big companies have got their own agenda, their own goals, their own budgets, which they need to allocate. And they'll move at their own speed as a result. So for you, a small company, obviously with a big big project, big asset there, certainly a big land bank, is how do you encourage a partner to come aboard and come aboard at a timing which suits you? Because time is money.
Yeah.
The longer this drags on, the more you're going to be burning through with that and having to raise money for it or sitting back and waiting.
Uh-huh.
Either way, you're kind of out of control. So what does that conversation look like?
Well, there's really a couple of different types of conversations. There are those people who have acreage in the play, like Shell are drilling right now. Santos are due to drill next year. But there are other players in Queensland who are not in the play, like Origin or Conoco or some of the partners of Santos and Shell, and they might want to get in. And typically the history in Queensland is that the people get a bit jealous if they're not in, and I say big companies can be somewhat emotional in that way as well. Then a completely different conversation is with some large American players who have over the last 15 years developed the leading expertise in developing tight gas plays like this. And we're softly engaging with a few of those. Now, there's been in oil and gas, people go overseas and they go back home and they go overseas and they go back home. And there's 100 odd years history of that. In the last 20 years, Americans have gone home. But certainly some of the ones that we're talking to, they're ready to go overseas again. But they're not going to go, first place, Zimbabwe or something. I don't mean to criticize Zimbabwe, but they're going to go, well, Australia, that's not too bad. You know, I'll bring my spouse over and they'll love living there. And it's relatively low sovereign risk. And tell you what, prices in America are less than $2. And here they're 12. Are these guys crazy? So those American discussions are potentially very fruitful. And there's a third category as well. There are, for instance, Japanese trading houses or LNG buyers who go, I don't mind owning molecules because I've got to supply Japan for, the next 50 years. And if I own molecules in Australia, I can hedge that bet fairly effectively. The government's not going to appropriate it. And, I've invested there as a Japanese trading house for decades.
Okay. So what does that look like going forward? You obviously done a phase set of drilling. It's the tests look quite good for now, but there's more to do. You got to finance this thing. So where are you with money right now? What's it going to allow you to do moving forward?
So our fiscal position is being boosted by this R&D credit that I mentioned earlier. basically the government's paying for half of everything that we have done and are doing on this well. And we have a debt facility secured only against that. It's plain vanilla. There's interest. There's no con notes. There's no nasties. And that can be used to manage our cash flows over the rest of this year until the R&D rebate is actually paid, which will be in around October.
How do you pay that with no revenue?
Well, basically, it works through. You know, we lodge a tax return, and then the government gives us a check back. So it's pretty attractive on that. So in terms of pay, you know, basically the interest just accrues in the meantime, and so it's quite an attractive form of debt, non-dilutionary equity, obviously. Our farm out discussions will include features such as not only for the incoming party to pay for future wells, but also to contribute towards back costs and provide a cash contribution. So that would be the typical structure of the farm out for this type of play, and that's certainly been a focus of what we're talking about.
Okay, and then let's kind of can you give me a sense of what you're going to be doing for the rest of this year? I mean, what results? Yeah. People like headlines. People, you know, like results. So what are we looking forward to?
I've got a little timeline here, but I'll show you a lovely picture of the flare that we just announced last week. That was
The thing these? I thought flaring was sort of being banned. I mean, you're getting attacked from all angles. Is flaring a thing?
In the good old state of Queensland, flaring is not only not banned, it's welcomed because it's a sign of successful discoveries. I mean, the key to flaring is don't emit methane, burn it. I mean, you know, it's a much worse profile if you have fugitive emissions of methane. And flaring is still required to basically do what that does. On this graph here, confirm that you have a stabilized rate that's controlled over many hours, that you've not just got a flash in the pan. And so that's what we did last week. In terms of time frame, I mean, this is what we set out at the start of the year. We're going to do this. And, you know, we've done 7 out of 9 so far effectively on time. There's always a risk of slippage in our game. And the rain gods will probably be cursing me and Bridget bring down their wrath. But to be honest, we've actually managed rain very well. There's been a lot of rain on this site, but it's not far from tarmac roads. We constructed a pad and a road very well and managed the deluge that recently came there very effectively. So in the course of May, June, which is now imminent, we will start a stimulation program. We've hired Halliburton to do that. They've taken input from their research center in Houston. We'll be applying some techniques that have been honed in the States but not really used in Australia before. Then we'll be flow testing after that. That'll be in May, potentially going into June. And then, hey, if we've done what we expect to do, we will have that commercial flow rate that we discussed earlier. The discussions that we're having in the background with the farm out parties will be informed by that. I'd then like to see, you know, in say Q3, a farm out deal closed, providing, you know, a carry and cash. And critically, the endorsement of a large party that this is a significant asset that they deem worthy of getting into.
Explain that a bit more, because that's really important. You talk about carry and cash. The carry we get, you carry through various work programs for your whatever percentage that you've negotiated. The cash component could look like what, typically?
So typically you'd say, I want my back costs, and then you haggle about that. And the back costs here, are reasonable. This is a significantly deep well, with a lot of stuff done to it. So, for instance, and I'm just making this up. This is not intended to be market guidance, but there could be, say, a $10 million cash component as well as a carry on however many wells for whatever forever equity going forward. So the cash would come to us to use on our balance sheet to, you know, pay the high price CEO, et cetera, et cetera. The carry would get deployed in the field for, you know, say, you know, a handful of wells that the incoming party would pay for and earn equity from. Again, typically on these deals, if there are a big company coming in, they want a certain pathway to becoming the operator, and that's just, you know, accepted. The big companies get that, and they deserve to get it. They've got a bigger skill set, a bigger team to do it, but it doesn't necessarily happen on day one, but they want a firm pathway to achieving that. And then they provide more muscle in terms of marketing and such like. So you don't need to do bad early deals because you're aligned with, you know, a big American guy who goes, no, I don't do bad deals. I only do good deals, and I'm holding out for
them. Okay, and so when you're kind of flicking through your presentation, that kind of would look like a headline, something with lab results. What are you actually testing in the lab?
A couple of things I just alluded to earlier. In the free-flowing zone of 4,200 meters, we took a sample of the sands that came out of the well there. We determined that they had, in effect, clay coatings of a particular type, which have preserved porosity and permeability at a depth which would normally not be expected. I mean, this is 4,200 meters deep. There's a lot of overburden. It's actually, in fact, significantly overpressured, which is great because then stuff wants to come out more quickly. And that's analogous to the Perth Basin, which had been a fabulous play where deep Permian zones that no one expected to flow have flowed really well. We also analyzed coals that came out from the drilling operations and confirmed that the gas content in them was really enormously high. 34 cubic meters per ton is a very, very high figure. And if I just do some, you know, somewhat artificial mass, we've got 65 meters of coal. We've got 1,000 square kilometers. We've got 35 cubic meters per ton. I mean, you just go in your head, and there's tens of trillions of cubic feet of gas in place there. Now, the recovery factor is not going to be high. It doesn't need to be high when you're starting with that much gas. And that's on top of the gas that's in the sandstones and in this deeper permeable zone. So, as I said earlier, the Bowen Basin's been enormously prolific, and that we found that there's a huge resource here, and we're finding out we can get it out economically, you know, knock on wood.
So give us the kind of highlights there, because I'm hearing you going, the Bowen Basin has kind of been giving up gas. You got lots of big names around you, you know, also doing what you were doing. There's a grid in place. There's a market, a sustainable market need in terms of price. What else should I be looking at and saying, well, actually, I think this thing, your job is quite, frankly, what my takeaway from this is, your job is quite simply get the gas out of the ground and everything else is set up for you. But you've got to find that partner to do that. So what's the sort of timing for all of this where I kind of see that massive upside?
So the partnership discussions aren't easy. As you said, big companies, they follow their own drumbeat. And we've been, you know, canvassing people since we got this asset, you know, so for, you know, a year and a half. And you need that sort of warm-up process. We're doing that through a number of different angles, as I mentioned, America, in effect Australia, and then in effect gas buyers. And we have different experts to help us in each of those. So we need to deliver the well outcomes that we've been planning for a long time and which we've been kicking goals on to date over the next 2 months. In parallel, pursue those, you know, commercial discussions with assistance of various parties. And then in Q3, we hope it all comes together with a significant farm out deal and really eyes not only of Australia, but of the world turning to a play that's got, you know, enormous potential not only for Australian markets, but to supplement the liquefaction plants in Gladstone that currently supply a good number of East Asian countries. I mean, I think it is getting eyes on it from bigger companies, and that will just grow as we issue news flow. I mean, to be honest, we've got Shell next door who's doing heaps, but they don't tell anybody what they're doing. So it's up to us to really put this on the map. And what you can sometimes see, some plays that are dominated by juniors are better known than ones where majors are doing their own secret things because the majors don't need to tell the world what they're doing.
Great position to be in. Well, look, I think that's a kind of good kind of romp through. I mean, you're sounding sort of quietly confident for this year. Just sort of quickly on the macro, and I know we kind of have done a few macro shows, but just kind of quickly on the macro, the Australian market kind of obviously is not necessarily influenced by what's going on out there in the rest of the world. But can you give us a sort of sense of how you read and scan the oil, gas, sector at the moment.
So the Australian market's really sort of split between the East Coast, where most of the population is, which is a very, very healthy gas market if you're a seller. It's a very bad one if you're a buyer. The West Coast is also a healthy gas market, but gas prices tend to be lower because there's more gas resources available from the traditional LNG fields and then the Perth Basin that I mentioned as well. Australian gas markets will become connected to world markets through LNG import plants. I mean, their pricing already takes signals from the export plants, which are on both coasts. But the import plant, and it has one that's been FID'd and it will be importing gas, that'll really kind of put a strong price signal as to what you need to pay to induce new supply. So in terms of responses to this, like many places in the world, oil and gas companies have not been deploying as much capital on exploration and appraisal as they have historically because of pressure from their shareholders or because they're concentrating on the backyard in the Permian Basin or whatever. So it's been the odd junior like us who's actually managed to get in ahead of the crowd to prosecute work at a low cost and efficient way that is really doing the work that used to be the work of the exploration departments and the big firms. But the big firms still face significant depletion. They still face the reality that the rates of return from oil and gas are far better than the other things that they've been dabbling in. And that will therefore induce the sort of investment from bigger companies that will develop this sort of area for its favorable characteristics that I noted earlier.
And isn't it the case that obviously with these large sort of grids, gas pipelines already in place, that so Queensland is almost incentivized to continue to explore and use up the gas reserves there versus building large capital expenditure projects on LNG imports? I mean, how do you kind of read that defense of your business plan?
I mean, brownfields is always better than greenfields. It's just a truism which is true. And that's the case not only in terms of Queensland, but if I look at I've got LNG plants here with spare and growing spare capacity. It makes more sense to develop gas to put into them than develop like new LNG plants on Mozambique or places like that are being mooted. And that's not only a sovereign risk issue, it's a very straight economic issue. So, in a rational world, and the world isn't always rational, but it tends to go towards rationality, then these resources should be developed to fill that infrastructure, not only pipelines, but the liquefaction plants, the gas-fired power plants, etc. And, of course, the owners of those pipelines and such like are massively incentivized to do that too, as well as the relevant regulators and sovereigns. So, and my very simple math as well is that you're better off from a climate perspective to keep using gas infrastructure that's already sunk than to actually construct, for instance, green hydrogen manufacturing facilities, which are expensive. And then you can offset the carbon emissions from the gas and in effect industry already exists through CCS or other mechanisms and be massively ahead economically. So I think these assets have got very enduring long-term futures.